This is Red Ice Radio. From the dream to reality. RedIceCreations.com.
Welcome back, everyone. It's good to have you with us once again. My name is Henrik, and I hope you're doing well wherever you are in the world. Gilad Atzmon was born in Israel in 1963 and had his musical training at the Reuven Academy of Music in Jerusalem. As a multi-instrumentalist, he plays soprano, alt, tenor, and baritone saxes, clarinet, and flutes. His albums, of which he has recorded 9 to date, often explore political themes and the music of the Middle East. Over the years, Gilad's music has moved more and more towards a cultural hybrid. Also being a prolific writer, Atzmon's essays are widely published. His novels Guide to the Perplexed and My One and Only Love have been translated into 24 different languages. It was first his service as a paramedic in the Israeli Defense Force during the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon that caused him to reach the conclusion that I was part of a colonial state, the result of plundering and ethnic cleansing. He told an interviewer that it was there he first learned about Palestinian refugees in Lebanon, legislation to prevent their return, and the wiping out of Palestinian villages. We were indoctrinated into a denial of the Palestinian cause. We were not aware of it, he said. Since 1994, he lives in London, and he is with us today on Red Ice Radio as guest number 3 in our series on Zionism and multiculturalism. On his website, gilad.co.uk, you can listen to his music and follow his writing on political matters, social issues, Jewish identity, and culture. Okay, welcome to Red Ice Radio, Gilad Atzmon. It is great to have you with us. Thank you for taking the time to be with us here today, Gilad.
It's a great pleasure and great honor for me.
We have so many things to talk about, obviously. It's sometimes even difficult to know where to begin, but why don't we just kind of briefly set the tone, if you will, a little bit, and maybe we can talk about your personal views in regards to Zionism, if any relationship you have to that, and what you think that this political concept has to do with Jewish identity and culture, Gilad.
Yeah, my it's quite difficult for me to summarize my views into one or two sentences. I just kind of finished writing my first book about the subject after writing thousands of papers, and it took me something like 200 pages. But in general, in my work, I differentiate between Jews, the people, Judaism, the religion, and Jewishness, which is how this is my term for Jewish ideology. Now, in my writing, I don't write about the Jews, about the people. People can be born to Jewish parents, they can be ethnically Jewish, and yet not to succumb to Jewish ideology. I also don't really talk about Judaism, because to my opinion, religions don't kill, it's the people who kill. I may criticize certain interpretations of Judaism, but I do talk about Jewishness. I'm really interested in Jewish ideology. Now, what is Jewish ideology? Jewish ideology is different forms of chosenness. So, for instance, the Zionist Jews go back to Israel, to Palestine, sorry, and decided they are entitled to live there and to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians because they were living there. That's what they think or believe, or their ancestors were living there 2,000 years ago. This is not a moral argument. This is something that we can only understand from a perspective, when we look into it from a supremacist perspectives. They're chosen. They live slightly better than the indigenous population. But on the other end, you know, the anti-Zionist Jews, sorry, the Jewish anti-Zionists, which is very different, the Jewish anti-Zionists have a very similar argument. they actually build a political cell that is racially orientated and doesn't allow a Muhammad or Abed from Gaza in. And I look into different manifestations of Jewish politics, and I try to analyze it. And what is very, very interesting is that my biggest opponents for doing so are actually the Jewish left and the Jewish anti-Zionists, which is amazing. Mm. Because they realize that I was probably the first one to point out the Jewish left is an oxymoron. Because Jewishness is a racially oriented supremacist view, and left is the complete opposite.
Right, right.
It's universal, at least it sees itself as inspired by a humanist ideology, as opposed to tribal. And I used to get a lot of flack for saying it. By the way, I still get a lot of flack, but I have managed to destroy, at least in the UK, the hardcore Jewish anti-Zionist cell, or at least to dismantle its hegemony within the Palestinian solidarity discourse here. And I'm very proud about it.
Excellent. I want to ask you about the evidence for this. We go back 2,000 years ago to see then as a kind of a proof that the Jewish people were living in that area of Palestine at that time. Now, do you know if would that still be considered to be religiously driven, though? Because we have to go into scripture to find the evidence for that, correct?
I think that a lot of research has been done on the topic. I think that it's not the most original, but it is definitely the most comprehensive work, text on the subject. I think it's Shlomo Zahn's book.
Yes, yes.
The Invention of the Jewish People.
Yeah.
I think that obviously it is clear that the Jews who live around us or in Palestine have very little to do with the biblical Hebraic Jew. And it is obviously clear to many researchers that if there are any real Jews, they are probably the Palestinians, the indigenous Palestinians. Mm. And the explanation is very simple. At the time, the Roman was... I'll take it the other way around. The Roman didn't exile the Jews. This is a myth. This is a myth that was largely invented later by basically Zionists, even before the first Zionists. It's a myth that came to celebrate to explain this mythological yearning. The Roman didn't expel the Jews because they didn't have the capacity to do so. The navy had better things to do rather than schlepping Moshe to Toledo and Yosef to Granada. Mm. As it happens, some wealthy biblical Jews or whatever immigrated, left the region, but the majority left behind. And eventually, some of them took Christianity. Some of them took Islam later. This is the story. This is the story. It is. I'm not original here. There are enough text yep. about it for those who are interested.
Right, and I mean, we're doing a series here, obviously, on this and many other, connecting topics, and I'm asking some of the researchers and writers out there fairly somewhat similar questions here as well, and I want to ask you, Gilab, why you think that this piece of land is important? Why this area? Why is this so important in the Middle East, Gilad?
Okay, so basically, for Jews, the area or the region wasn't that important for very many years. And this explains the size of the Jewish diaspora. In fact, they realized that they really want to, some of them realized that they really want to move to the region in the late 19th century, and even then it was just a marginal factor within the Jewish, world Jewry. In fact, it only after 67, it became a generally accepted idea among Jews. Even in 48, there were 600,000 Jews in Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
So now this is one issue. On the other hand, the region has become important due to energy issues, petrol, oil in the region, and the British Empire realized late 19th century that they have to move from coal to oil, mm-hmm. if they want to maintain their hegemony, and this is why they interfered with Iraq already then in First World War, which is battle that not many people know about. Actually, saying interfering is quite gentle considering what they did there.
Right.
Yeah. It was a serious war, and not a very successful one. And this is the story. And the Zionists were very, very clever in understanding the geopolitical struggle. They were very effective to capitalize on, to mobilize their political power, and they made this region into a more important. Now, anyway, this Zionist philosophy turned into Israeli, evolved into Israeli strategic outlook. They've managed to convince some silly Americans that Israel is their best ally, and that Israel is a strategic asset. The most pathetic idea that the Americans were willing to buy for some reason was that Israel is the ideal runway for American forces. So in case America needs to intervene in the region, which is now do actually,
yeah.
Israel would provide them with all the military facilities. You know, they can launch attacks from Israel. Now, as we see by now, this has never happened, and it didn't happen for a reason, because if America has to attack an Arabic state, the last state it would try to be associated with is Israel.
Yeah.
All right. So we saw it already in the first Iraq war, the second Iraq war. So this entire American strategic philosophy is completely groundless.
Now, is this, Gilad, why also so much money from the U.S. military is given to Israel? I think in 2011, we're talking about $2.9 billion, something like that.
Yeah, by the way, I guess that it's not... I was always amazed kind of how the American American people let Israel take so much money, because for me it's quite a lot, you know, it will take me a few years to to gather such an amount, you know, being a journalist.
Well,
but,
this way, yeah.
You know, I really have to walk out. But but then there was a credit crunch and a financial turmoil, and I started to see trillions bouncing from, you know, changing hands. So I realized that it must have been peanuts what they give to the Israeli state. So I cannot anymore think of in these terms, but it is very clear that even one penny is one penny too much.
Right.
You know, Israel shouldn't get, you know, a cent. Sorry, we should be talking about America. You know, I'm living in Britain, so yeah. Even Israel shouldn't get a cent, and actually Israel should start to pay for the damage it inflicted all those years on the region and on world economy and so on.
So, at the end of that agenda here, do you think, Gilad, that the Zionist faction, the political ideology, have been used by other people then, who primarily have the interest to occupy the region, or is it driven by the Zionist political ideology?
The Marxists, whom I not approve at all, like to think that it was colonialism or colonial interests that created Israel. And this may as well be the case when you look at the early stage, but it's definitely not the case anymore. As we know, Jewish lobbies dominate American and British politics, immense influence in France, and so on.
Mm.
And again, once you start to talk about Jewish lobbies, it would be the Jewish Marxists who are the first to attack you and to discredit you. But I believe that we must talk about Jewish lobbies. And I, by the way, don't call them Israeli lobbies as others. I think that we are dealing with Jewish lobbies. Lord Levi is not an Israeli. He is a Jew who thinks that by supporting Israel, he serves Jewish interests.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? Now, I think that even when we look at the this colonial paradigm, we find some problems. For instance, the Balfour Declaration. The Balfour Declaration, I always thought, I never understood why Britain decided to join forces.
Right, right.
And it took me many years, you know, there is the Jewish or the Zionist or the Israeli narrative that Chaim Weizmann was a great scientist and the Brits really wanted to give him a present, and he was a Zionist and they didn't know what to do, so they gave him a state. This has never happened in the history. It's complete nonsense. Obviously, you know, if the Brits kind of at the time really liked someone, they would give him a bit of land, you know, and a nice castle.
Right.
You know, and obviously Palestine was more than just one castle. And then I learned from an Israeli writer, Amos Elon, the real story. The Americans, the Brits realized in 1917 that they wouldn't be able to win the war without the Americans joining in. They tried to mount some pressure on America, and they got a response from British Embassy in Washington that it is not going to happen. I quote now, in the telegram it said, there is a Jewish conspiracy against us here in America.
Mm.
why there was a Jewish conspiracy, because American wealth at the time was handled mainly by Jewish bankers, and these Jewish bankers were primarily German Jews who were very, very patriotic. And it was the secondary force was Russian Jews who were very pro-Germans, because the Germans were fighting the Tsar, who was anti-Semitic. This is not a conspiracy theory. As I told you, I read it in Amos Elon book, The Pity of It All, a book that I highly recommend, and I made my investigation, and you can find quite a lot of information about it. The Brits realized that in order to pull America in, they have to give a serious, they have to give something for those Jews. And then Balfour came with a genius idea, and this was the Balfour Declaration. And 3 months later, America was in the war. So this is not exactly the Marxist tale of the imperial forces inventing the Jews, but this is actually some Zionist or Jewish tribal forces manipulating the empires. It's completely the other way around.
So, do you put much credence into the ideas of British Israelism, or the British Israelite movement?
Sorry, what do you mean by that?
Well, this is the concept, a belief, I guess, that the British royal family have, are directly descendant from the line of King David. Do you know about this?
I'm really not an expert on this topic.
Right.
No, anything that I may say about it is meaningless.
All right. Well, I thought this might have been interesting because something to do with the Balfour Declaration, considering that Arthur James Balfour, he wrote a letter to Baron Rothschild, right? He was the leader of the British Jewish community.
Yeah.
So I guess I wanted to ask you as well if you think that this might, on the outset, just have something to do maybe with the Rothschild family alone, that they are behind the creation of Israel because they wanted it. What do you make of those ideas?
Again, I know that there are quite a few people who are expert on the Rothschild affairs. It's something that I always wanted to learn, but never found the time to do it. I'm not expert on the Rothschild affair. I'm specializing in different forms of the construction of Jewish identity politics. This is what I specialize in. This is what I write about. I would take I don't know, Israeli policy or Israeli spokesman speech, and I would try to explain or to understand myself how this such a statement or a policy fits into the notion of Jewish ideology.
Absolutely. And I want to ask you a little bit about the conference or the meeting that you're having. This is tomorrow for you, obviously. This program will be broadcast a little bit more later on. But tell us about this panel, and also tell us about some of the opposition, I guess, you've had to this panel, Gilad.
Okay, but basically there is this conference that's organized by a person who is familiar with my work. The conference title is, I don't remember the order, is Israel, Zionism, and Jewishness. We had four panelists lined up. Rada Karmi, who is a Palestinian activist and a writer. John Rose, who is a Marxist an opponent of my views, Alan Hart, who is again a writer, he's kind of a celebrity in Britain. He used to be a panorama specialist for the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
I think that even you know, I was a kid, but he was in Israel in 67, talking to all Israeli generals. You know, he has a serious history.
Mm.
Once the Zionists noticed this conference, they were horrified and they started to mount some pressure. Within hours, the Jewish anti-Zionists joined in. Something that wasn't a big surprise for me, because I argue that there is a total continuation between Zionism and Jewish anti-Zionism. I think the Jewish anti-Zionists are basically proxy Zionists, those who operate politically. As you know, within a few hours, John Rose caved in, and he actually had an argument. He thought that the conference would be an opportunity to battle with my ideas, and he didn't like the title. And I think that the organizer made a mistake. It was a procedural mistake. He didn't consult with him about the title or the subtitle. I think that John Rose complained about the subtitle. The subtitle was a reflection on Israeli-Palestinian conflict in the light of Goldstone's retract.
Mm-hmm.
So he had an argument. I spoke with him. He said, "Listen, Gerard, I will debate you any place, but I couldn't do that." I guess that as a SWP member, he couldn't handle sit in a conference that question Jewishness.
Why?
Because there is a certain why.
Mm-hmm.
You asked.
Yep.
Don't ask me. You can ask him. I can give you his telephone number. because the real answer, the real sad, the tragic answer, is that Marxism could, and not Marx, I'm talking about Marxism, could as well be realized as a continuation of Jewishness. Marxism is in itself has become a form of chosenness. You know,
mm-hmm.
We know the right explanation. Listen to us.
Right.
It's dogmatic like Judaism. It had become many years ago a kind of a Talmudic scholarship. It's tragic because when I go back to Marx and read it, I'm fascinated sometimes, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even Marx's understanding of religion is much more open than what the Marxists make out of it, which is a banal form of atheism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to say that religion is opium for the masses was actually very complimentary. anyway,
mm-hmm.
He was subject to enormous pressure by Jewish groups. By the way, not many Jews. I can think it's probably something between 3 to 12. Radha Carmi was also subject to similar pressure. I myself saw some internal emails from Jews, people who operate as Jews in the movement, like Jews for Palestine or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I saw an email from a woman called, she is a kind of a leader within this Jewish network. I never met her, but she's bragging in this email about the pressure that she mounted on Rada with some other BRICUP. BRICUP is another a kind of instrument, political instrument that was supposed to help Palestinian academics. So what we see here, there is my internet stalker, you may have come across his name. His name is Tony Greenstein, who mounted pressure Rada in the name of the BDS. The BDS is the Boycott, Divestment, Sanctions, mm-hmm. which is another instrument that was created to put pressure on Israel. Now, what we see here is that those people who operate as Jews, the problem is not that they are Jews, is that they operate politically as Jews. Can you see the difference?
Yeah, of course.
For sure. The people who operate politically as Jews are exploiting a political instrument that was created to help Palestinians in order to silence other people in the solidarity movement. And this, unfortunately, reminds me too much of the similar things that happened in Russia right after the revolution. The revolution that was created to serve the Russian people soon after turned against the Ukrainians and then many Russians and then even, you know, the Marxists themselves. You know, and I think that it's very bad. I don't know, you know, I always have a dilemma here because I don't want to cause too much havoc, you know, in this movement. But already once or twice in my life, I left with no option and I exposed those tribal infiltrators. A few years ago, I wrote, it's a very funny piece, and your viewers, you know, if you need, I can send you the link. It must be still on the net. I wrote a piece called The Protocols of the Elders of London.
Right.
It's a funny piece, and I basically, this is 2005 or something like that, I could, they in the open, on the kind of on open forums on the internet, they were discussing who to kick out from the Palestinian solidarity movement. It was a shocking document, and I collated all those statements and made a very satirical piece out of it. And I looked at it again, and actually, all those people who were adamant about who to keep in or who to kick out, none of them is in the Palestinian solidarity movement anymore. So A, it wasn't that important for them. B, I've managed to destroy them. Now I don't seek destroying the destruction of anyone, but I really like integrity.
I mean, these questions are always, unfortunately, in one way, sensitive to discuss. There's a lot of taboo around this, and then of course we have the whole area of anti-Semitism, something that always is thrown around when one tries to find answers around Zionism or if one is critical of Israel, for instance. What do you make of all these things? Why is it so sensitive, and why are these anti-Semitic you know, things thrown around all the time when we try to find some answers?
I published I think a strong piece about it yesterday, titled "Why Are They Afraid? Why Are They Afraid of Us Talking About It?" I can think of two reasons. One, they're afraid because they themselves don't know what Jewishness means. However, they realize that it may be sinister like hell, that it may be a Pandora box. So they prefer to keep it under the carpet. And within the protection, within the concept, within the discourse that dominated by political correctness, they were quite effective in silencing any form of criticism, because political correctness should be defined as a political stand that doesn't allow political negation or opposition. Okay,
yeah.
This is so one option they don't know, but they prefer to keep it like that. Now, this is not surprising. Such a view is not that surprising, because this is very consistent with Judaism. Because in Judaism, you are not supposed to understand what Judaism stands for, what is Jehovah is all about. You are supposed to observe blindly. This is the secret of Judaism. Okay? So they say, we don't ask what Jewishness, we just follow, you know, we are anti-Zionist, we go to demonstration every Saturday, we go to the Israeli shop, and we put flyers, and that's the way they work. Rather than going to synagogue, they go to their daily, you know, it's not about thinking,
right.
It's about acting.
Right.
The other option, the second option, is that they actually know very well what Jewishness stands for, and they think they know very well that when it's not something that others can digest easily. So they keep it secret and they do whatever they can to silence opposition. And you are from Holland, yeah?
Sweden.
Ah, Sweden. Why? Sorry, I thought it's for one reason. I thought that you're from Holland, from Amsterdam. Sitting me now, I remember. Yeah. Anyway, no. Why I ask whether you are from Holland? Because there is a very interesting story of Uriel de Costa, who was a Jewish intellectual in the 17th century, living in Amsterdam. Portuguese origin, very similar story to Spinoza. And he went through different horrendous sagas of exclusion and excommunication. Why? Because he had some crazy ideas. For instance, he came up with the idea that it's actually people who invent religion. You know, it doesn't sound that bizarre, but this was enough for his rabbis to decide that he should be excommunicated and be punished. And he, if I remember it correctly, he was had to lie on the floor, and the community had to walk over him.
Oh, Jesus!
And at that stage, he couldn't take it, and he killed himself. What we see here, the measures that they try to implement against me and against others in this movement are very similar. So we have to ask, what is common to those cases? Spinoza, you know, why to start with Spinoza? Let's start with Christ. With Christ, Spinoza, Uriel de Costa, Israel Shamir, whom you may have met if you live in Sweden, Finkelstein, Chomsky, Jeffrey Blankfort, myself, they always use the same tactic. Now they are very unsuccessful with me. Why they're very unsuccessful with me? Because I'm not an activist. I'm not a member of any movement. I don't want to be any member of any cell. I'm just a jazz musician.
Yeah.
I'm a successful jazz musician. By the way, I will play in Sweden in October.
Ah, there you go.
In Uma Festival.
Does it ring a bell? Umeå?
Uma Festival. I can find out how it's called exactly.
Yeah, that would be interesting. In October, you said, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a jazz musician. I'm a successful jazz musician, and I'm a writer, and I write myself, and I don't publish it anywhere. I just send it out and let it be.
Yeah.
I don't need the approval of anyone. If you know, I don't have at all ego as a writer. I remember that my first publisher saw my second book. you know, and he gave it back to us after 2 weeks, and it, to my literary agent, and his comment was that it was the worst piece of literature he's ever seen, you know, and I could stop myself laughing. He was probably right, you know. So that's it, you know. They cannot destroy me, and they cannot stop me. And even if they stop me physically now, I've done my job. I've done my writing. My book is ready. It is scheduled for October. But if they hurt me physically, I'm sure that the publisher will manage to release it within a week.
what is the title, Gilad, of the new book coming out?
The title is actually titled that... I borrowed from editor of a woman that used to be my editor many years ago, and not many years, my wife said many years ago, 2 years ago, Mary Rizzo, and she gave a good title for one of my papers, actually a paper about Shlomo Zand. It is The Wondering Who.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Interesting.
And it's a study. It's basically a study, a deconstruction of Jewish identity politics. And I really didn't stop myself from getting as far as I could. However, as you can see, this entire discussion in my entire work, there is no a hint of racism or any reference to Jews as race people or blood or genes, because the problem is not with them being a people. The problem is with the culture, with the identity, with the philosophy, with the metaphysics.
Right.
And this is and I think that they should be the first people to listen to me. And in fact, I think that it's happening now. It is happening. I'm off to America on Wednesday, and I'm set for very many meetings with Jewish political leaders who want now to open the discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm talking about important people. I definitely don't want to become the king of the Jews, because I'm not a Jew myself anymore. But I think that Israel is definitely past the no return zone.
Okay.
Israel is finished.
Hmm.
But I think that diaspora Jews or world Jewry still can do some things to amend the damage that inflicted on them by the Jewish state.
Hmm.
And I'm not a politician, so, and I'm definitely not a Jewish leader, so it's not down to me to say what are those things, but I can definitely point out at the problem.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to talk with you a little bit about multiculturalism as well, and maybe we can tie it in with what we've been talking about so far. We'll see about that. But I heard from you, you know, as a musician, one of the most interesting and I think important perspectives when it comes to multiculturalism. This is a video of you up on YouTube. You
yeah.
put it in the context, obviously, of playing with various notes. But what is happening now with multiculturalism is eroding that. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that with us, Gilad.
What is the question?
Well, the question basically is what you see multiculturalism doing to the different cultures around the world. I mean, we're given the illusion, if you will, that this is going to be great for diversity and so forth. But the strategy
yeah.
of multiculturalism
yeah,
is
sure.
quite the opposite.
Yeah. You know, it is a very deep question, because it feeds into one of the most the most complicating and not well understood political debate.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, I see multiculturalism as a flattening mechanism. I believe in cultures, in real interaction. And I believe in cultures actually struggling against each other. There is nothing wrong in struggle. When I play with a Greek Pontecleira player, or with an Arabic singer, or with a Syrian oud player, I want to hear the struggle. Now, we created this image of happy-clappy living together, you know, in our music. We basically play hip-hop, and we fit kind of, a singer from Ghana on the top.
Right, yeah.
And it is pretty devastating, and obviously, though it was created to convey the image of tolerance, our society is far from being tolerant. In fact, I prefer to meet an open racist rather than a person who uses so many deceitful tactics to hide his hatred toward others.
Mm-hmm.
One of the biggest problems that we have in the Palestinian solidarity discourse is that the left is Islamophobic to the bone. If you ask a white Marxist who he would feel better sitting with, if it's Paul Wolfowitz, if he, you don't ask him, you just put him, throw him into a room, and there are two tables. On one you have Wolfowitz, and the other one you have Bin Laden. He will go and sit with Wolfowitz. This is clear.
Okay.
All right. So, why he would sit with Wolfowitz? Because we really didn't go through a real melting process that would lead to a real compassion and empathy towards others. Instead, we created an image that we are happy to feed. And this is exactly what multiculturalism is. Now, I'm regarded as one of the greatest heroes of multiculturalism, because always in my music, you have different elements.
Mm-hmm.
But in my music, I try. I let these elements live. I let these elements live, and I am not afraid even to negate them, but I don't try to follow this false aesthetics, you know, that present it as an image of calmness and utopic harmony.
Mm.
Now, why did I mention earlier on that it is a very, very contentious subject? Because this reminds me a very early debate between Marxism and Nazism. One of the arguments that I'm talking about early Nazism, I don't go into racism and all this. One of the arguments that I've read by Nazis against Marxism, they said, you see, those Marxists, they try to flatten our human landscape. But it is not true. This is inhuman. We are not the same. We are very, very different. We are very, very different. And actually, the celebration of differences is the real meaning of humanity. And when I read it, you know, because I'm at the end of the day, you know, I'm coming from my background, my cultural background, you know, is in the left. So, you know, I was slightly devastated by it because I thought, oh my God, so this could be a kind of realized as a counter-humanist argument. And the more I thought about it, I realized that there is a point for to present the struggle as a humanist point of view.
Yeah.
And I accept it, and this is why I don't see myself for many years now as part of the left. I want to think to be free to think,
yeah,
what I want to think. And I can even see a point, you know, this is kind of a, maybe it's, I say that it's a Nazi because I heard it in a Nazi text, but this is basically the philosophy of laissez-faire. It's a liberal or capitalist philosophy. You know, let be, and let us think. And I think now, one of the reasons that I have so much opposition among three Jewish leftists is because I believe that they can see very well that I have the intellectual power and also the charisma to dismantle their discourse completely. And I will, because I think that what they did for years is unacceptable.
I think that there is so many oxymorons both in the political left and right. As soon as you put yourself in one of those boxes, you're going to end up in a situation where you can't explain certain things, and that's why I like your particular point of view. This is about being free, using your own rational mind,
exactly,
and see where you end up with that, you know. And
exactly. Now the problem that they have is that if I don't fit into their idiotic box, they assume immediately that I must be right wing. No, but I'm not a right wing either. And what is the most interesting stuff about my writing? You really find it on the most radical lefty magazines.
Websites and things like that.
Yeah, yeah. Website, yeah. And as well on hardcore right-wing magazines, also magazines that probably would believe that I should be dead for having the wrong genes in me.
Right.
You know, it
right.
makes me laugh. You know?
Stupid. Yeah.
But I really don't care about these things. I think that thoughts should be out there in the air. This is why I believe in the net.
Yeah.
I believe in the net. I believe that what you're doing, what others are doing, is the future.
Absolutely. And we need to begin to round things up here for this time, Gilad.
Yes.
And there's so many points, obviously, that we haven't got to, but we appreciate your time. It has been excellent to hear from you and from your perspective, and we'd love to have you back at some point as well. But let's just run through some of the basics again. Why don't you give us your website and tell us the title again of the book you have coming out now in, was it October or November?
Yeah, I think October it will come in English. It is called The Wondering Who, with question mark, big question mark. And most important, people should listen to my music, because in my music, you know, you can listen to it in the car and it's all there. All my thoughts are there. My latest album is called The Tide Has Changed. I'll be in Sweden in October in Uma Festival. And my website, is www.gila.co.uk. Make sure that you have the HTTP, because if not, you go to my old one, which is looks horrible. It looks horrible, but I still keep it alive. And what else do you want to know?
Well, I want to just re-emphasize again the website address, gila.co.uk. Take a look at the book, obviously, and of course, check out the music as well. I've really been enjoying what I've heard from the website, Gilad. So,
thank you so much.
Absolutely. We'll see if we can make it up to... was it in...
I would be delighted to be another one. Today, I'm doing something pretty outrageous. I tell you what I try to do. It's because you will like it. I have a friend here who is she's a Muslim, and she's covered completely with hijab, and you know, you can only see her eyes.
Right.
And she's a political activist. She's famous here. Her name is Layla Stewart. She's English convert and from north, from Cumbria. And she told me yesterday that in the Jewish Museum, they have now exhibition about coexistence between Jews and Arabs in Morocco in the 50s or 60s. And I thought it would be a good idea to go with there to the museum with the camera and to see how Jews cope with coexistence now.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I expect it to be a very funny film.
Okay, well, look at that. Check it out. Are you going to have it up on your YouTube account later?
Yeah, I will have it. I have time to edit it, and I have the seminar, and from the seminar 2 hours later I'm off to America.
Okay.
I'll actually edit or give someone to edit it.
Sounds good.
It could be hilarious. Okay.
We will let's stay in contact, and we'll let you know obviously when the program is up on the website, Gila. But for now, thank you very much for your time, and take good care.
You are very knowledgeable, and I really had a good time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
We have gotten quite a few answers to our quiz already, but it's still open for you and your guests, of course. If you have been listening to Program 1 and 2 in this four-part series, you know that we're doing a music quiz. We're looking for a word, and the clues are in the music we play at the end of each program. If you think you know the word, send an email to redicecreations@gmail.com, and we're going to give out 4 3-month subscriptions. Stay tuned for part 4 coming up soon. Redicecreations.com. Keep an eye on the website for the latest. Thank you for listening. Talk to you soon.
Do you remember the first kiss? Stars shooting across the sky. Such a place as this. You never left my mind. I'm watching from the wall. watch the stars now.